The Walsh Sisters is a six-part Irish drama adapted from Marion Key's novels Rachel's Holiday and Anybody Out There. It follows five sisters, Claire, Rachel, Maggie, Anna and Helen, as they confront addiction, grief and family feuds while they navigate life, love and sisterhood. Netflix brings us another family drama. This time it's the Guinness brewing dynasty in House of Guinness. The series explores the secrets and the scandals and the rivalries between siblings Arthur, Edward, Anne and Ben immediately after their father's death in the mid-90s. 19th century. And finally tonight, Wayward is a new thriller from Netflix. Follows two teenagers who escape from the notorious Tall Pines Academy for Troubled Youth in Vermont. Stars Toni Collette as Dr. Kate Reed, the enigmatic and dangerously charismatic founder of the Academy, who's hiding dark secrets in a seemingly idyllic town. Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser have watched all three and they're going to join me now. First up tonight, the Walsh sisters. Chris, set this up for us, where we are in the story, because even if you're familiar with the books, there's been some shifting around of characters and times here, hasn't there?
There are, yeah. And you're speaking to someone who hasn't actually read the Marion Keyes novels from which this series takes its cue. But I understand that we're going with, looking at two novels here, Rachel's Holiday and Anybody Out There, and that stories and characters and exchanges from those two novels have been plucked for this series. Adapted by Stephanie Prisner and Keffi Shadrick, it finds the Walsh sisters scattered about all different parts of, different beautiful parts of Dublin. And it's straight in at the deep end. We see Rachel, played by Carolyn Menton, who lives with her sister Anna, the Walsh sisters, that is, played by Louisa Harland. They are on a mad night out in Dublin, and it's just bananas from the beginning. It's just shots and dancing and mayhem. And the next morning, one sister wakes up engaged. You know, don't worry, she actually had a boyfriend before that. She's engaged to her American boyfriend, Aidan, played by Samuel Anderson. But the other sister, Rachel, doesn't wake up. Now, eventually she does get there, not before her boyfriend Luke calls an ambulance, and then she actually scolds him for that. But you're left wondering from Luke's reaction, you know, is this a one-off event that Rachel says, you know, it is, or is this a regular occurrence? Does this happen every week, every weekend? And most of the first episode then is based around this weekend where, you know, the sisters who were out, they kind of go to let off some steam at their mum and dad's. Their mum and dad, played by Carey Crowley and Aidan Quinn. And that's where we see some of the other sisters. Stephanie Prisner plays one. She plays a sister who is desperately trying for a baby, but, you know, it's not happening at all for herself and her partner. We have Daniel Galligan's Claire, who is celebrating a divorce. And then we have the younger sister, Mairéad Tyers, who is still at home and really hasn't got the money to move out. And we just get to spend a little bit of time at the parents' house, kind of just exploring, as you mentioned at the top, their sisterhood, their bond, but also maybe, you know, potentially some of the things that come between them.
Okay, Chris, you came from that end. Jen, you didn't. You've read Marion Keyes before.
Yes.
So what
read
was
and loved.
And so therefore, you're part of the target audience here. How did you feel about the very beginning part of this? Because obviously it does mess somewhat with the books.
Yeah, and I think it's a huge challenge for Stephanie Prisner, because how do you tackle those beloved Walsh characters and bring them to the screen? And it's a lot of responsibility to make them familiar to the, you know, the faithful and introduce them to the uninitiated. And by merging those plot lines of the books, I think you have enough familiarity there for people to hook them in that have read the books. But also you have that challenge because you love these girls. You know them deeply if you've read a lot of the different books, even, you know, Rachel's Holiday, Watermelon, all of those, you know, books. And it's all about the characterization and it's about bringing them to life. And I think the first episode, I've only seen one episode just to say, but it's a bit of a whirlwind trying to give everyone their sufficient screen time. And I think it will settle down as it goes on, but there's plot lines galore, as Chris has outlined. They're all over the place. But I think the key thing is it's about the interrelationships with the sisters and how they knock about together, how they work together. And I think there is going to be unfortunate comparisons to Sharon Horgan's Bad Sisters. You have to get this out of the way, especially with Bad Sisters' first season, when you saw this unbelievable chemistry between the actresses playing the Garvey girls. It was savage slagging. They're all speaking over each other and it felt very lived in. It felt very real. These relationships felt extremely close. And I don't exactly see that as of yet with these Walsh sisters. It sometimes feels that they're just women in a room with each other, with some characters, and then other characters, you get this feeling of a very close sisterly bond. And I love when that happens. And I think somebody that stands for me head and shoulders above everyone is Louisa Harland. I think she has the right tone for this kind of show, and you're hooked in to Anna being in this impossible situation almost, because you can tell that she loves her sister, her tearaway sister, Rachel, but she is in denial about her problems. And it's a very Irish mentality to stick your head in the sand a bit and be scarlet to even address those major issues. And she's so good at doing that. She's so good at having that older sister sense of protectiveness about Rachel. That's spot on. And it's great to watch that, because you kind of feel she's in a bit of denial about her own life as well, where she accepts this proposal with this really brief romance with Aidan. It seems like they're not together for a very long time. So there's that dichotomy there that she's concealing a lot, and a lot is coming to the fore. And Louisa Hartland does that effortlessly, I think. And I think she's great to watch in this episode anyway.
Okay. I want to take something from it, and I want to expand it out ever so slightly, because this involves the mammy and the daddy as well. So this is Stephanie Prisoner playing Maggie. She goes home for Sunday lunch with gifts for Mammy Walsh. And in the clip also, Mairead Tyres as Helen and Danielle Galligan as Claire.
So you have two options. You have flowers or chocolate.
You are such a licker.
What?
You always complain about mum's demands and then you give in to them.
Yeah, Helen, for quite a lot.
In fairness, you have created a monster to a point.
Thank you.
I'm going to watch the golf with Jack.
Okay, bye. Ugh.
Hello.
Hiya. Sorry, thank you so much for getting those bits, Maggie.
You have two options, chocolate or cookies.
I'm not giving her chocolates or biscuits. She'll say I'm a feeder.
Well, they're the only options I have, Claire. She's not wrong, though. Mum's already in a bad mood, because I fell asleep at mass.
I'll give her the flowers.
You'll kill them.
I'm giving them to her in, like, 5 minutes.
Still.
I'm capable of keeping things alive. Thank you very much. You sound like James.
How is James?
I have to be careful now because of Elsevier's.
Kate, should we go inside and say hi to Nanny and Grandad?
Yeah. Where's Auntie Rachel?
Shall we see if she's inside?
Okay.
Right, go on about James. He wants me to bring her over because he's missing the birthday tomorrow.
Just exhausted. I'm dragging her through airports. Like, why is it always me that goes over there?
I know. But she loves to see him. And he loves to see her.
Don't do that, Maggie. You always take a side.
I don't. I'm just saying you should bring her.
I will, don't I always? I'm just saying that being a parent is a gender imbalanced cesspool.
Okay.
Chris, we haven't quite made it to Mammy and Daddy in that one. No. What about Aidan Quinn and Carrie Crowley?
Oh, they're very good, because we get the sense that they are almost at a stage where the final daughter is about to move out, but that daughter doesn't really know what to do with her life. And Aidan Quinn's Daddy Walsh, like, I think they're referred to as Mammy and Daddy,
yeah,
Walsh. It sounds a little strange. But he is still, you know, bankrolling her. You know, she wants to go to a festival. He sends her €300 to go to that festival. But that's
But he does
not,
it quietly at the table while
does,
no one else is watching.
And that is a sign, perhaps, that there are cracks in the relationship between himself and Carrie Crowley's character, because she's, you know, saying to him, when's the last time we went out? When's the last time we went on holiday? She wants to go on a cruise. I think she wants her life back with him. So there, I am looking forward to seeing, you know, more of that relationship and more of everyone, because as Jen was saying there's a bit too much of everything in episode one, but not enough of anything at the same time. And I do like the rapport between the sisters, but you do get a sense that they're supposed to be in one another's pockets. They're supposed to know one another inside out. I'm still waiting for that. And I think it will come eventually, but I am still waiting for that snap, crackle and pop, because again, it might be unfair to compare it to Bad Sisters, but that show almost felt as if it was workshop beforehand. Those relationships felt so lived in. With this, it might be down to just some of the writing in terms of just the introductory stuff, that it's almost like the character, one character says something, especially the dinner table stuff, one character will say something, it's like there's a break for a laugh, and you're thinking to yourself, this is not a sitcom, it's supposed to be a comedy drama. So I do think it will settle. I do think there are fireworks up ahead, and also, you know, it's basically, the first episode is about setting all the pieces in place. They're in place now, and I am looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Jen, I talked to Stephanie Prisoner and Ian Fitzgibbon, who's the director here on Arena, earlier this week, and one of the things she had said was that the characters have all been set up, with some of them kind of turned up slightly more loud, some of them turned up slightly lower, with a view to presumably future series focusing on different sisters. Does that get in the way of this?
For me, because I'm a big Helen fan, the youngest sister, and she's played by Mairead Tyres here, who we know from Extraordinary, and she's a great comic actress. And I think Helen in the books, she is the wit of the Walshes, and she's sarcastic, but she's also quite louche and a bit understated as well. She's a strange presence. She can strike a strange presence within the book. Here, she's a bit of a woke scold. She's a bit of a Gen Z alarmist. She's correcting everybody, reprimanding their behaviour around the dinner table, you know, taking her mother to task, saying she's fatphobic. And it's kind of hitting these issue buttons, these hot topic issues. And like Chris was saying, I found that a little bit too much. And also, you're waiting for that character to come in to its own. So I really hope that she does get the chance to flex herself a bit, because we've seen what a good actress Mairéad Tyrs is, and she's well able for the material. So I can't wait to see that, definitely. But I also think Aidan Quinn's accent is very good.
It is, actually, yeah.
And I think he's using those twinkly eyes. He's ever done.
Yeah, he's using the twinkly eyes to great effect as this man that I think will be a dad that's very relatable to people, that he's mostly silent but fair, and he's trying to keep the peace and stay out of the way. And I think that's something that a lot of people will recognise, and maybe in their own homes.
And Chris, just in terms of the bad sisters thing, one of the things I thought when I was watching the first episode, visually it does take reference to some of that, those things that Bad Sisters did really well, of taking parts of Dublin and making, almost making them look like they're not in Dublin. They don't have those traditional, this is how Dublin is supposed to look in a series of this nature. There are a lot of those shots along the coast. There's a lot of aerial shots and making parts of Dublin look very beautiful.
Yeah, it's an advertisement for Dublin, and it's a good one. And yeah, I was wondering if it was made to export, but it also does that frustrating thing where carriages might be in one part of Dublin and then the next they're across the other side of the city. So that can be a little bit frustrating. But it is a beautiful looking series, and I think an awful lot of effort has gone into, you know, the writing, the casting, but just how it looks. And sometimes we don't get that with dramas like this, so I am glad that that's the case. I'm a sucker for emotionally charged Irish family dramas, like The Drive, for instance, which I think is another series that this will be compared to. And I also quite like the fact that over the next 6 weeks we are just going to get one episode a week. And I think if The Traitors Ireland, for instance, has taught us anything, other than the fact that apparently we still love reality television so much, it's that Irish people still like to watch telly at the same time as their neighbours. So I am looking forward to 1 hour a week being, you know, the Wallace sisters being a part of basically my viewing schedule.
Okay, stars out of five?
It's a 3.5 star opener, and we'll see where it goes.
Jen?
I'll give it a solid 3. It's a challenge to contain the characters that have been in and out of several novels in just 6 episodes. So I wonder where that will go, and how can you have that space and time for all these unruly women and all their everything they want to bring to it. So let's set it up for the next season and the next season after that, and I hope that's what happens with this.
That's The Walsh Sisters, and we spoke to director Ian Fitzgibbon and writer and star Stephanie Prisoner on Monday's Arena if you want to listen back. Next up, more siblings fighting each other, this time in House of Guinness in the mid-19th century on Netflix. The four children of the brewer and MP Sir Benjamin Lee Guinness. Jen, bring us up to speed on this one.
Oh God. I think we're reaching peak Guinness, guys. I think we really are at this stage. We're like saturated in judgmental TikToks from, you know, British influencers telling us how to drink a pint. I don't know. It's somehow become synonymous with this surge in Ireland of new music as well. It's everywhere. So why not have this succession like drama about the family themselves? So the setup is succession like. So they're dealing with the aftermath of their patriarch Benjamin Guinness's death and leaving the family's livelihood and legacy up for grabs, with what direction it will take in these very turbulent times in Irish history, you have to see. So you have Anthony Boyle. He's very much camping it up as this villainous, and he has a mustache that he actually twirls in it a lot. So he is the eldest son, Arthur, and he's conflicted about taking up his father's seat in Westminster and the responsibility that that will have on him. He'd like to be carousing around London more so than anything else, and rather than representing the family's interests. So he's a bit of a liability. Everyone's a bit of a liability in this family. But family want him married off to give him that air of stability, but he's this caustic presence and he's ready to boil over at any point. Then you have the idealistic Edward, who's played by Louis Partridge. He wants to take hold of the family business and begin to promote a more benevolent side to the brewery to calm down the social and political tensions. And that brings him into contact with the Fenian element of Irish society. And then you've got the spooky sister Anne, who's played by Emily Fearn. She seems very much lost to another world and is very concerned about her place within the family as the only daughter. And then there's the incompetent Benjamin Jr., played by Fiona O'Shea. He's a reckless addict. He wants to play the hero, but he's running up significant personal debts and he can't seem to settle down. So in between all of this, they're a very mixed bunch, and then they're aided by James Norton's muscle presence, who plays Rafferty. He's a sort of fixer who endeavours to keep those pesky Catholics and normal folk out of the Guinness's way. So, I mean, that's a massive play. That's a massive element of inter-family dynamics, which with Stephen Knight, I mean, from the beginning, and I mean from second one, you know where we are at with this. This is, you know, Peaky Porter. Is basically what I'm calling it.
Yeah, Chris, because it is made by Stephen Knight, written and created by him, who's responsible for Peaky Blinders, and the two of them share a lot of stylistic similarities.
They really do. Where do we start? So we have that modern soundtrack for a start. Like, so there's an awful lot of Fontaines D.C. here, the Scratch, Kneecap, a lot of contemporary Irish music, which in my books is no bad thing at all. I just think maybe it's a little bit overused. And a big thing with Stephen Knight is, and I quite liked Peaky Blinders at the beginning, seasons 1 to 3, there was a good story there, there was a good, you know, great characters with Sam the Ill and Killian Murphy, that cat and mouse game kept me watching. Then it went off the boil. I think it went off the boil long before it was, you know, it finished on the television at least. But it took basically, with Peaky Blinders you had a real history there. There was, you know, a real Birmingham gang, and then Birmingham gang called the Peaky Blinders, and Stephen Knight just applied an awful lot of fiction to it. He's doing a similar thing here where he's taking real people and then saying, oh, I'm not going to tell their actual story. I'm just going to dress this up. And it's the dressing up that I have an issue with. I think his depiction of Dublin, and it's not just Stephen Knight, it's Tom Shanklin's direction too, but their depiction of Dublin is all over the place. So according to Stephen Knight and Tom Shanklin, the Dubliners towards the end of the 19th century spent most of their time fighting one another. This series never mentions what or indeed who the real problem is. And that really annoyed me. And there were times during the series where I thought, it's okay to, you know, make things up, that whole, you know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. But I really wish there was a sign across the screen saying this did not happen at all. Because it spends so much of its time putting other things across the screen. There's this thing that it does every now and then where a character might mention a sum of money. And then this writing will flash across the screen telling you that's £1.5 million in today's money. And it's such a weird and unnecessary gimmick in a show that's just full of weird and unnecessary gimmicks.
This is all presumably because this program is made for a Netflix audience and thus a global audience. So in theory, as far as the creators are concerned, that's not that important.
No, but it's going to be, it will be interesting to see what the reviews are like here as opposed to everywhere else. But here, I mean, it's depiction of the Irish Republican Brotherhood or the Fenians. You better get used to that word because they mention it a lot. It's like every single member of the IRB is dressed as if they're going to a St. Patrick's Day parade. The language is far too modern. And what I mean is the dialogue, everyone speaks in these kind of contemporary metaphors and riddles. But it's not even just the Irish aspect. I found problems with the way that it's made too, the way that it's lit, the way that it's acted, some of the accents as well.
I mean, the accent work is, I actually was more impressed with the accent work than I probably should have been. I think Louis Partridge does a really good accent that nobody is mentioning. I think he dials it down so it doesn't sound too weird to your ear. But I also think, you know, it's a hard accent to get right. And I think James Norton is mumbling a lot, but he's also doing
it's not
his best.
Bad.
He's doing his best. I think that, you know, they're okay. But I wonder about when you're doing that with Irish actors, they seem to be amping up their Irishness or their Irish accents. And I find that jarring. It's not actually the UK actors. It's the Irish actors that I'm kind of worried about going, really?
Yeah, Michael Hepburn actually does that.
Well, let's take a clip from it so people can have a listen. This is Dervla Kerwin's Aunt Agnes, and she meets with her niece Anne to discuss how things have changed in the family. Dervla Kerwin and Emily Fearn.
Anne? Perhaps you're not aware of the change that took place when the will was read out. Arthur and Edward now own the brewery. They also now joined heads of the family.
Meaning I do as they tell me to do.
They will need help. Men are easily fooled. Rich men attract clever women.
Clever is a good thing.
Remember, whoever Edward marries will become one of us. We will have to live with the choice.
I have plans.
What absurd times we live in. Women with plans.
Oh, excuse me. That is from House of Guinness. Chris, I've seen comparisons to Victorian succession in many, many places. We spoke to Stephen Knight as well earlier in the week here in Arena, and he said he'd never seen Succession, but that he understood that, that you might take those comparisons. To be fair, there are a lot of similarities in this, both in terms of jealousies, ambition, four siblings, three men, one woman.
Yeah, there are. I don't quite believe Stephen when he says that, to be honest. Look, it's like Succession, but, you know, stripped of, you know, the smarts, the clever dialogue, the rich and wonderful characterization. There is a good setup here. There is a good story and there's good characters. And also, there's a great cast. You might think from all of the things that I've been saying that, you know, I don't admire the cast here. I really do. I thought even Danielle Galligan, who is jobbing this week on
Claire
The Walsh Sisters.
Walsh Sisters.
Yeah, and here is playing a woman who is brought in basically to act as a bride for Arthur, who is a closeted gay man who is, you know, understandably worried about, you know, his secret coming out at this time. And when she's brought in, it's a little fireworks display, and I think it brings out her performance. There's something so natural and something so warm and funny about it that it brings out the best in all of the performers around her, particularly Andrew Boyle. Sorry, you asked about Succession. It's not like it basically, it has three men and a woman who don't know what to do after their rich father died. That is where the Succession comparison ends.
And they're just fighting between themselves.
That's all.
But I do think that performance is great, like you said, from Danielle Galligan, because I think there's an intelligence to it as well that you need to slice through. There's a lot of macho male brawniness to this show because Stephen Knight wants to attract the Peaky Blinders audience, the worldwide audience of young men, and that is a big part of this. Like, even when the show starts, it flashes up like water, hops, yeast, power, you know, secrets, money, all this on the screen, and you're just howling with laughter because it's over egging this sensibility. And, you know, I just think with Chris, like you said, I mean, the Anglo-Irish politics and relationship, you know, in the 19th century is a complicated, complex issue, and I think to reduce it to playing kneecaps, get your Brits out during a scene where they're attacking the coffin of Benjamin Guinness is something else. And I felt that the Irish of the time amount to sketchily drawn punch cartoons, and they're not afforded the subtleties of the Guinness family, which is sad. And it makes you wonder what Stephen Knight sees in Ireland and what the wider world sees in Ireland. I mean, are we still reduced to these tough drinking, fighting semi-savages? And you get the feeling that including, by the inclusion of the music and kneecap into all of this, it's sending a certain message that's too neat, too simplistic, and appeals to the certain demographic that want to engage with Irish politics on a very surface level. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And I think if you had it just stuck to the Guinness family story, those dynamics are enough.
There's enough there,
to be getting on with.
Chris, we're talking about the filming of the Walsh Sisters in Dublin. This is set in Dublin, but almost none of it is filmed in Dublin because, as Stephen Knight said earlier in the week in the interview, Dublin doesn't look like Dublin as it did in the mid-19th century. Does that get in the way of it for you?
Yeah, but Manchester and Liverpool doesn't look like Dublin in the 19th century. I think it's a weird excuse. We don't want to film it here, but we'll actually bring it here when it's ready. I don't buy that at all. It actually, unfortunately, the problem is that it looks like it was made on sets. It is enormous, and an awful lot of money has gone into, you know, making it look as authentic as possible. But I mentioned that harsh lighting. It's all over the place to close it in. They don't want you seeing any sort of anything contemporary in the background. So it does look a little bit stagey at times. So I didn't really like the look of it. Maybe the stuff outside of James's Gate at the beginning, when there is that riot in the streets and when Benjamin Lee's coffin is going by, there is something quite epic about that. But for all of the money that's been pumped into this, I'm not seeing it. Maybe it went towards paying the cast. Fair play to them. They deserve the work. But in terms of the way that it looks, I wasn't impressed at all.
Stars?
It has to be two. I mean, I was going to describe it as a historical soap opera, but it's not. It's a bit of a cartoon. It's clunky, it's clumsy, it's cartoon. I don't think the cast are at fault here at all. I think it's the people behind it. We're better than this. The Guinness story is far more interesting than it's depicted here. And also something that we haven't touched upon yet, I think its biggest problem, it's very dull. And a story about the Guinness family should not be dull.
Jen?
I think there's great acting here from Anthony Boyle. I think he's a star on the rise, and I think he's always interested and magnetic to watch, and he really is here, and he's chewing the scenery, but he seems to be really enjoying himself. I love Emily Fearn. I think she is a great actress. We've seen her in The Responder and Rain Dogs. There's something about her that's very odd and strange. I think people enjoy the bombast and the fun of it all, but I'd rather a bit of silence in the chaos and a bit of stillness that even pulling a pint of Guinness asks you for. It asks you to wait a bit and give yourself a bit of time. So I'd like that sense of reflection than just splitting the G. So I'd give it a 2.
Okay. Finally this week, we have Wayward on Netflix. It's a psychological thriller based in a reform school in the seemingly idyllic town of Tall Pines in Vermont. Chris, set this up for us.
Well, right at the beginning, we see this runaway teen who is just scared for his life. He seems to be escaping a high-security correctional facility. The security guards are putting up a chase. And we hear this woman's voice. We'll later learn that it's Toni Collette's voice speak out on speakers all around this field where the kid is running from. And it's just panic on this kid's face. And we're thinking, where is he escaping from? Who is he? What's happened to him? We need to go back. But actually, we don't follow him. We follow the story of Mae Martin's Alex Dempsey. Mae Martin being the comedian, actor and writer who actually created the series and is also one of the lead characters. And Alex Dempsey is a police officer and a trans man who has moved to the idyllic town of, I was going to call it Twin Peaks there, which we'll come back
we'll
to.
We'll come to that.
Tall Pines, Vermont. This is where Alex's wife, Laura, is from. Laura's played by Sarah Gadon. And they are apparently in search of a fresh start. I won't tell you why, but let's say Alex, who is a police officer, had a very bad day on the job in Detroit, and they do actually need to start over. But unfortunately, on Alex's first day, he actually comes across that runaway teen and is asking questions like, what happened to this guy? He's injured. Is he okay? Turns out he is a student, if you could even call it that, of the Tall Pines Academy, this sort of therapeutic school for troubled teens, where basically parents send their teenagers if they've acted out, if they've been caught smoking weed in school, if they're just not behaving in a way that the parents wanted them to. And then parallel to this story involving Alex Dempsey, we have two teenagers in Toronto whose parents are actually threatening to send them to that facility. And we think one of the girls, Layla, she is going to end up there. But it's actually her friend Amber who ends up there before her. And then Layla devises this plan to basically go get her.
Okay, let's take a clip from this. This is 16-year-old Layla and her friend Abby smoking a joint before their school day starts, played by Alvia Allen Lind, let me get that right, and Sydney Topliff.
This song came out 30 years ago.
We were born in the wrong era, dude.
1176.
We're rich.
Dude, when we move to Vancouver, we won't even need money.
Okay, we'll be living off the grid. We can grow whatever we need.
Shit, we should live by a river and then we can irrigate the land.
Irrigate the land?
Dude, I got 13% of my English essay last term. I'm too dumb to irrigate the land.
You're not dumb, Abby. It's called dyslexia. Look it up.
I can't look it up. I'm fucking dyslexic.
My dad called me a parasite the other day.
What?
A parasite. I know, right?
Abby, that's really messed up.
Shit.
Oh, we gotta go.
We need to do the honors.
John Paul George Ringo,
we honor you.
I do like that. Jen, something like this needs obviously very strong performances to keep it going. What do you think of Mae Martin, Sarah Gadon and Toni Collette?
Toni Collette, oh God, like come on. We've had Nicole Kidman and Julianne Moore playing cultish leaders in like Nine Perfect Strangers and Sirens. So why not welcome Toni Collette into this strange genre? And she does it so well. It's what you expect from her. She's fearsome. You're terrified of her as Evelyn and you don't know what her motivations are, but it really draws your attention to woo-woo industry and what this is disguising perhaps, and it taps into those themes about being a teenager, you know, those camps that we used to watch a reality show, Brat Camp, on Channel 4, and we thought it was fun and games seeing these kids, you know, get sent off, shipped off to something that's akin to a military school academy. But this, there's a danger here. So it's all about what are you doing with these teenage brains and how impressionable they are, and about free will almost. So there's a lot going on here. And I think Mae Martin as a performer, as a character in the show, is such a naturalistic performance that I would like to see them in a HBO gritty drama. I think they'd be able to tackle it. And I think they're a great writer and they have a lot to say. If you've seen their previous show, Feel Good, which I think is amazing, and a lot of people haven't watched that yet. It's on Netflix. There's two seasons. Outstanding. And they're very good at tapping into the emotional capacity, the emotional register that's necessary for something that is quite lightweight and silly sometimes with the two girls. And I think they're great. They kind of touch on that Pen 15 knockabout humour, which I love. Mm. And the lovely close friendship between them. It's got a lot going for it that I really enjoyed.
Yep. Okay, Chris, let's circle around. It is a small town mystery thriller. There are some quirky characters in it. There is no Lady with the Lug, however, but Twin Peaks, you have to make some form of comparisons.
Oh, absolutely. And I think Mae Martin will be okay with that. I mean, the original title of the show was Tall Pines, so I'd like to think somebody sat down with Mae Martin and said, we can't do that. We have to come up with a different title here. It wears its influences on its sleeve, but it's what it does with them that makes all the difference. And I think there's a whiff of Stephen King off of this, and that's a good thing in my books too. I think the mystery is fun enough that I'm willing to forgive maybe some of the more formulaic setups and maybe some of the simple dialogue at times too. There's a warmth and a natural, like I thought Mae Martin was actually terrific as Alex, and I love the stuff between the girls. A slight criticism would be maybe that the 2003 setting, you know, it works, and it works because the girls can't maybe contact each other quite as easy as they would if you said it now. The teenage girls, that is. But unfortunately, it's another show where it's not enough to basically have a soundtrack from that time and someone carrying a Discman. A bit more effort has to go into the hair, the outfits, the actual vocabulary as well. It's like, bring it back. This was 20 odd years ago. There's a way to make it sound as if it was 20 odd years ago, but I'm willing to push that aside because the performances are so good. I was creeped out by it, and I think that's what Mae Martin wants. And also Toni Collette. I mean, Toni Collette at this stage has so many unsettling performances in the vault. I thought we'd maybe seen every shade of it. Apparently there's more, and I'm here for it.
And number of stars, please.
I think I'm going to go with 4. I'm about halfway through it at this point, but I'm going to keep with it.
And you've gone slightly further, Jen, in terms of episodes.
I mean, sometimes it doesn't marry the tones together sufficiently enough for me, and there's a lot going on that could be streamlined into a snappier show. I think it can over-egg itself sometimes, but I think it has to be commended, the writing and the acting. And I think a character like Layla could have been a one-note brat, but they actually make it so lovable. They make her so lovable. I think it's great. I think they're, you know, definitely hit on something truly successful. I think Mae Martin will. This might not be it, but the next one may be the one. So I think 3.5.
Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser, thanks for coming in tonight. The Walsh Sisters begins on RTE1 Sunday at 9:30. House of Guinness and Wayward are now streaming on Netflix. You can listen back to our Arena interviews with the Walsh Sisters writer Stephanie Preisner and director Ian Fitzgibbon, and with House of Guinness writer Stephen Knight and actor Dervla Kerwin, available wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Biffy Clyro are back with Foutique, their 10th studio album. It leans into the band's signature mix of huge choruses and tight riffs from a band that's gone from Kilmarnock outsiders to festival headliners in about 3 decades. Irish band Sprints follow up their Choice Music Prize-nominated debut with All That Is Over. Fronted by Carla Chubb, the band channels personal and global turbulence into dark, tightly crafted punk songs that prove that they're carving their own sound. And Robert Plant, the legendary Led Zeppelin frontman, returns with Saving Grace. It's the debut album from his band of the same name. It reimagines roots, blues and folk songs with his raspy vocals and Susie Dian's harmonies. Plant shows that even at 76, he's still exploring and still making old music feel alive. I'm joined by Danny Kilmartin and Kate Brennan Harding, who's going to be in our Galway studio. Evening to both of you. We're going to start with Biffy Clyro, and we're going to play something first. This is Hunting Season. That is Biffy Clyro. It's called Hunting Season and comes from the new album Foutique. Kate, Biffy Clyro, big, huge, anthemic choruses. People probably know them best from many of horror. So how are the hooks and the production on this album?
Well, Rick, the hooks and production are there in abundance. It's in their DNA. They can never let that go. The band have had a 4-year sabbatical, so to speak. They thought that they actually mightn't come back. They've been formed since 1995. and they had a hectic touring schedule, and obviously the pandemic and various other personal issues took them out. So they're back. Their fans of Yvy Clyro are going to absolutely love this album because it does exactly what they do, but they are kind of more in love with what they do, I think, on this album. And obviously the song that we just heard there, it had me for the first bit, but that's because it kind of was a bit more Kasabian-esque. And when it goes into, I think, the parts of Yvy Clyro that makes me, my ears switch off, is when it goes into the chorus and it goes into that major, suddenly we're so happy about what we're singing about, and it kind of drives me mad. But Yvy Clyro fans will love that.
Danny, the album title, Futique, which I presume I'm pronouncing right, unless somebody else wants to correct me on that. Simon Neill, the frontman of the band, he's described it as philosophical.
Yeah, so what he has said about the album is that it's an exploration of ideas, objects or relationships that exist across time. And that itself is, you know, it's a grand gesture for a band that are often pegged as a radio rock band. And as grand a gesture as it is, I don't really feel that the lyrics stretch to meet the ambition that the concept kind of reaches for. There are moments where it kind of lands, like say an example, True Believer, like that hits the sweet spot where the harmonies come in, or Goodbye, or It's Chemical is about as quintessential Biffy as you get. But there's a bit of a sense on the album of a band that are very much resting on their laurels or treading familiar water. It's a Yvy Clyro album, you know what I mean?
because at this stage of their careers, Danny, bands who are of Yvy Clyro's vintage, you can, it's very hard to reinvent yourself at this stage, and more importantly, your fans don't want you to.
That's it, though. I mean, like you alluded to it at the very beginning, they have kind of shifted from these noisy outsiders from a small town in Scotland to bona fide festival headliners, and they've been at it for, I don't know, about more than 10 years now. I think they founded in 1995. At this point in a band like that's career, you wouldn't expect that reinvention would really be on the table, and they've kind of settled very nicely into the Pixies quiet, loud dynamic a little bit, you know?
Let's have a listen to that. You mentioned True Believer. We'll take a little bit of that.
Do you want to be forgiven?
Yvy Clyro, True Believer from the new album. Kate, you mentioned that they took a break before making this record, and they'd had years of kind of heavy touring and burnout before that. Do you think that pause has made any difference to what they do?
I think the only difference that it's made is that they've come back kind of falling in love with each other. I was reading an interview with them, and they were talking about how they were just kind of, okay, right, we'll try our old songs out, and suddenly they were admiring their younger selves. They were like, oh wow, we've really done this, we've really got there. So I do really enjoy that kind of renewal of love for something that you're doing. And in the album Futique, they are exploring what they do, but from a more mature sense, in terms of honouring maybe that they might have fallen out with each other, or honouring their past selves where they might have made mistakes. So I think there's a lot of sentiment in the album that is nostalgia driven, but their sound is still, you know, pure Yvy Clyro.
And Danny, you did mention that the Pixies quiet, loud, quiet thing. You're right, it's quite obvious in this. Is that a good thing? Does that influence it in a positive way?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, look, I'm a big fan of the Pixies and a big fan of the quiet, loud dynamic when it's done well. But when you get to a point where Yvy Clyro are, I mean, look, if I can be frank about it, I feel like they've kind of been singing the same song that they've been singing since Mountain came out back in, what was that, 2009 or something. It sounds great, but at the same time, it sounds all too familiar. So, por qué no las dos, I suppose, like a little bit of both.
Okay, let's, Danny, start from you.
3.
And Kate?
I'm being kind by giving it 3, but I do think that it's a nice nod to that era.
Okay. Next one up is Sprints, All That Is Over. Kate, just remind us who Sprints are, first of all.
Okay, Sprints are a Choice-nominated band. They first released their debut EP and single back in 2020, so we're in 2025 now. Letters to Self was released only at the beginning of January in 2024, and now we have them here with All That Is Over, which is fairly quick, hot off the heels of the success, because they've been touring non-stop as well. So similar to Fontaine's trajectory in terms of constant touring and also getting Choice-nominated, and now, bang, they're out and back and here with this phenomenal album.
Okay, so the debut gets in the Choice Music Prize nod. Is this a build in the right direction, do you think?
It's a build, it's a stepping into, I think, what they've always had, which is their true identity. I think they've managed to capture. Carla Chubb is absolutely amazing live. And over the course of their touring, I reckon that the band has had this magic alchemy that happens when bands sort of live, breathe, eat everything, do everything together. I think that this album sort of, it's enabling them to step into the next realm where more people are going to hear them, where they're going to see them live. But also sonically, they did this lovely thing where they brought people along with them. So the first single, Descartes, is kind of, you can, anyone who knows what Sprints are, who they are, they will go, oh, that's a Sprint song. And as we listen to the album, they start progressing and evolving and experimenting with different sounds, which I'm sure we'll hear in a minute. But it's basically them stepping into their own identity with power, them believing themselves more. And I have to mention Daniel Fox, who is the producer on it. He's been with them since day one, and he's phenomenal as well. He's like the fifth element, so to speak. They're just, I'm just very excited about this album.
Danny, so the band have been touring relentlessly, and Carla Chubb has gone through some fairly major life changes on the road. How do you think the album reflects all of that kind of turbulence, or does it?
It does. I mean, like, the band's volatility is very much reflected in the kind of turbulent sound that you find throughout the album. Carla Chubb has been pretty vocal publicly about, you know, breakups and the band's lineup changes and the kind of disorientation that the leap into full-time musicianship has had on the band, you know. And it's all kind of filtered through this really, really kind of restless live sound on this album. Tracks like Need and Beg, for example, they really do embody that turbulence, and they flip between like emotions for whether it's desire or anger or exhaustion. That being said, though, it's not relentlessly harsh. I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk more about the other dynamics within the album in a few minutes, but it really is a very complete album. It's a solid follow-up. They really do deliver on the weight of expectation, I think.
Okay, let's have a listen to something first. This is Sprints from All That Is Over. It's called Beg. That's Beg from Sprints. So Kate, Carla's vocals, they're described as raw, they're described as versatile. She does the gentle thing and then she does the whole full-blown rock star. How did you think her vocal performance worked across the album?
I think it's absolutely magnificent. I mean, there's parts in it where she suddenly starts whispering where you really don't expect her to. And like, you know, the thing with music and you, if you know a band, you can sort of hear the what's coming next, you know, if you're really into a band. And there's times when I'm really delightfully surprised because Carla's taken a complete and utter curveball and thrown that like at me. But I think Beg there, that track we've just listened to, it's so ominous and it's synthy, and it's her lyricism as well is fantastic in that. And I love that because I think we're following along with Carla's, you know, in a prolific moment in her career in terms of her lyricism. And I think as well what we're hearing is like the juxtaposition of the light and dark and her rage and her softness and her voice between rasp usage, much more gentle usage that people wouldn't have heard her do before. She's pulling it off with aplomb.
Okay, stars from you?
It's getting 5 out of 5 from me.
Okay. Danny?
3.5.
3.5.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I just think it's fantastic. There's a song on it, the closing song, Desire, and they go on to this whole other theme almost with Spanish guitars. It's absolutely phenomenal.
I think that's a highlight.
I can hear your shock all the way from Galway. Okay, Sprints, All That Is Over. We're going to look at the new Robert Plant album after this. This is Friday Night's Arena. We are reviewing this week's albums with Danny Kilmartin and Kate Brennan-Harding. Robert Plant's Saving Grace. Danny, Robert Plant, he's been exploring very varied musical directions for a long, long time in his career. Do you hear any hints of what he's done before in this, or is this something completely new?
It's very similar to what he's done before. I mean, but not necessarily in a bad way. Like, to be fair to Robert Plant, I feel like he's kind of spent the better part of about 50 years kind of resisting the weight of his own legacy. You know, he could very easily have leaned really hard into the hard rock persona that he had, but he's done world music. He's done Grammy-winning experimentations on bluegrass with Alison Krauss. The only hints on this album of kind of past works, well, granted, now it is very much a bluegrass album, but there's kind of subtle nods to even Led Zeppelin. Like, take, for example, Chevrolet. That's a rework of a Donovan track that was borrowed from Memphis Mini, and that's a blues standard that he's done before with Led Zeppelin, or someone he's covered with Led Zeppelin before on When the Levee Breaks. It is kind of, it's more of the same, but it's not to the album's detriment, I don't think.
Okay, let's have a listen to Chevrolet before we go any further.
Mm-hmm.
Even in 2025, that's the fairly unmistakable voice of Robert Plant. The song is called Chevrolet. So, Kate, Susie Dian's vocals are on this album as well. How do you feel about her harmonies and how they interact with his voice? How does that kind of shape the mood of the album?
Well, I think I've been very used to over the years hearing Robert duet with Alison Krauss, and I've loved those duets. And I think that Susie comes in here, having obviously worked with Plant for the last 6 years, and what I think some people would call his new band or saving grace, even though they've been 6 years together. I think there's a beautiful tenderness. I think that Plant steps back and lets her vocal sort of entwine with his. And I really admire how you can step into that kind of place where Alison Krauss has been standing for quite some time, even though I know that this is a different body of work and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, no, it's just incredibly tender. And she gets a few moments as well where she's leading lead vocals, and Plant completely steps back as well across the album. And they explore all these different themes and these different genres within Roots music, but they sort of bring it together in this lovely alchemy. It's brilliant.
Yeah, Danny, there are intimate and tender moments on the album. Some of them are more intense. There's even some that are a bit kind of psychedelic on it. Does the album kind of feel cohesive as a whole?
It does. I mean, it's the pardon me, sorry. It's whatever way they've rearranged the tracks, even the kind of strange indie kind of side journeys on, say, their cover of Lowe's Everybody's Song or Moby Grapes, It's a Beautiful Day Today. They somehow managed to just make the album feel like it's this well-woven tapestry. I think a lot of it owes to the kind of rustic instrumentation that they've used throughout, like, say, Barney Morse Brown's cello or Matt Worley's banjo. Like, it's very earthy. The interplay is fantastic throughout the album. Somehow they managed to make all of these disparate kind of sound song styles work in this very well thought out folk and bluegrass album.
Kate, the interesting thing is they recorded this during lockdown. Some of it's even recorded outdoors. Mm. Can you hear that in the performances? Does it make some of the recordings kind of unique?
I don't know if you can necessarily pick out where everything was recorded. So there's a lot recorded in a barn, and they've worked on these for 6 years. So that's why I know what Danny's saying around kind of how they've made it cohesive. I think because they've spent 6 hours honing these songs that they were obviously in love with, and that they wanted to then create a new sound around. I think as well you do get a rustic collective feel. You don't get a full wrapped around studio and overproduced feel. You get this beautiful kind of sense that you're sitting in a sphere watching them or listening to them. I think as well that Plant has obviously kind of enjoyed getting to know other musicians and not having to be the lead, so to speak, even though he's Robert Plant and he can't not be the lead.
Stars from you?
It's getting 4 out of 5. I think it's a whirling, tender dervish. I think it catches all of the varieties of Roots music, and I think it's a perfect weekend accompaniment for this early autumn.
And Danny, from you?
4 as well.
Okay, 4 from both of you. We've been listening to Biffy Clara's Futique Sprints, All That Is Over, and Robert Plant's Saving Grace. Danny Kilmartin and Kate Brennan-Harding, thanks a million for joining us.